The evolution continues. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
We want everybody to come on the floor.
Vibe Collective, CIUT 89.5 FM. We are all back in the studio today, except for Melinda. She's on her way. And we are Jams,
Kemba,
Luam,
Victoria Grant,
Adrian Worrell,
Brandon Hay.
Yes, our distinguished guest, Brandon Hay from the Black Daddies Club, founded in 2007. And we're really happy to have Brandon here today. Been trying to get him on the show for a minute. And thank you to Victoria for making this happen. So for those who are not familiar with us, we are heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. From 3 to 4, we have roundtable talks. We talk about important issues like social justice, decolonization, identity, and
love.
Yes.
I took that.
And queer resistance and revolution and love. I want to say love again.
Yes.
I'm going to say celebrity gossip like I do every week.
Yes, indeed.
And did someone say environmental racism?
No, we were waiting for you.
Waiting for you.
That's your line.
Not trying to steal your shine.
That's right. So that's what we do every Saturday. We have a round table reasoning session, and then from 4 to 5, the DJs bring you music to move you, which we will be doing later on in the show. But first, we're going to get to our guest. So back in 2007.
Actually, okay. Before we start that,
yes.
I just want to take a moment because something significant happened yesterday that I think we need to take a moment and stop. Herman Wallace died last night. After being released for, 3 days? He'd been held in solitary confinement for 42 years. He was a political prisoner. He was somebody who was concerned with the liberation of black communities. He was somebody who was concerned with making sure that black people could self-determine. He continued doing his work when they locked him up. He never gave up. And so I just want to make sure that we take a moment to honor his transition, to give space and to hold space that he meets the ancestors and that he's met with home, something that he fought for all of us to have. So just a moment of recognition for the struggle of Herman Wallace, for the struggle of all political prisoners who are currently incarcerated, and to just remind us that we need to recommit to the daily struggle of liberation, of self-determination, and that we need to collectively and defiantly and courageously keep the struggles of Herman Wallace alive.
Well said.
Yes. Thank you for that.
Snap.
So, in 2007.
Yeah, no, that was really important. Thank you.
Thank you
for taking that time for Herman Wallace, and we do hope that the ancestors are there meeting him and as his transgression into the next realm. So back in 2007, I remember hearing about this prior to 2007. Maybe it was like a community buzz I was hearing or something along those lines. But according to the website, back in 2007, you founded the Black Daddies Club, Brandon Hay.
Right.
And it was a response to the lack of forums and spaces for black men to discuss parenting issues, as well as the issues facing the black community as a whole. So once again, welcome to the Vibe Collective.
Well, thank you for having me. So what should I do? Should I just talk about like where it came
ahead,
about? Essentially, BDC came about out of my own needs as a black father, looking for support, looking for spaces to really talk about challenges that I was having as a black man, but also a black father. You know, so making this transition. I was still battling of what it means in terms of masculinity. Or black masculinity, but then to flip on top of that is like, what does it mean to be a black father? You know what I'm saying? So growing up, in terms of, just to give a little background, you know, again, I always say this, like I was raised by my mom, and she was sort of who shaped and grew me. And then there was like echoes from my uncles, and then my dad was still in Jamaica at the time. But in terms of black consistent masculinity or black fatherhood, you know, I always throw the example of the Cosby shows and seeing Bill Cosby. But the reality of what I quickly realized when I became a dad, that wasn't my reality. You know what I'm saying? So it was important to have spaces where I could go to and find mentorship, you know, and have spaces where I can ask tough questions about fatherhood, but also about masculinity, which was sort of on top of mind at that time, still on top of mind at that time now, you know?
So can you talk about how, you know, how you brought people together for the first meeting and how it's evolved from 2007 to today?
Yeah, so when we started, we didn't know if there was going to be a need for it. Talking to a couple of my friends who were dads at the time, kind of getting their feedback is like, you know, is this something that's needed or whatever? So we did like these small fire events, and we did one in Kensington, one in Malvern, one in Brampton, and one in North York. And again, it was just trying to connect with individuals, you know, organizations that would give us space for free, you know. So we had topics around things that we thought black fathers would be. Intrigued or interested in, and we got good turnout. But you know, when we took a stock and kind of looked and reflected, we realized there was more women than men that showed up. Right, so it was like 60% women, 40% men, and that's sort of been indicative in terms of like movements throughout our history. You know what I'm saying? But for me, I wasn't happy with that. It was a movement for fathers. You know what I'm saying? And women are like has a place in that movement, but at the same time, it was a space that, you know, it was foreign, like for black fathers to really come and talk. So someone suggested we go to the barbershop. There was a program that was going on, More Than a Haircut, and someone said, "Yo, like, you know, they have a good model. We should like look at kind of taking that or borrowing it." And we did a pilot down by Onyx Barbershop across from Eaton Center. It was on Victoria Street at the time, and it kind of went from there. Like, so the parameter of what BDC is about is really the three mandates is, A, it's creating safe spaces for black fathers for us to talk about our challenges as well as our victories. And it goes back to that piece. It's to decrease that feeling of isolation that a lot of us are going through, whether you're a father or just a black man in general. Mm-hmm. The second is around working with the media. So basically to create an alternate narrative that's what is already being the populace or the popular narrative in terms of what black father is. But this is where storytelling comes in and the importance of storytelling and we being our own narrators, you know. And then third is around education. It's the space that we have or we try to create is not us trying to give, you know, speak our own propaganda. It's really about collective learning. Mutual learning. Everybody has something around the space to give. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So it's important. It's really about the humanization of black fathers. You understand what I'm saying? And with that being said, it can't just come from one or two men. It has to come from everybody in the space. Everybody has something to give, their own story. And it's like that's how we have to build it. We call it the movement built on love. You understand what I'm saying? But really, it's about humanization of black fathers and black men. And it's really... that's sort of like in my own head. That's how we kind of keep it. It's sort of guided by, you know.
I just wanted to ask you a personal question. I wanted to know what fatherhood means to you?
Fatherhood, I think fatherhood for me has changed. Like, my eldest son is 11, so it's definitely changed. So what I mean by that, I was talking about this the other day, like, when my first son was born, Tristan, it was this idea of, like, yo, like, I was working at Sears at the time, and Sears over by Eaton Center, the men's shoes, and I was, like, you know, making a little pocket change, but it's just, like, yo, I'd go into the mall, and I'd pass, like, a Gap Kids, and I'd get, like, ecstatic, like, yeah, I want to put my kid in this kind of thing, you know what I'm saying? And it was really around materialistic, what can I offer, like, you know, like, money-wise. And then it transitioned, man. Like, I think, again, and this is, again, in spaces with other fathers and taking that learning, you understand what I'm saying? It's like, the reality of it is that quality time, trying to find moments in terms of what my youth can bond, but also pass on my own history. So, like, a story I like to share is, like, when I was growing up in Jamaica, when after it rained, we used to, like, take, like, bottle stops or whatever it is and, like, catch, like, the rain. Mm. And, like, it was like the rain was guttering on the streets, you know what I'm saying? And we used to, like, race and so forth. Mm. And then one year it was raining and I picked up my kids and we were home and I was like, yo, let's go outside for a minute. And we picked up some pine leaves or the cones or whatever. Not the cones, but the leaves, you know? And we picked different sizes and we named it. And then we all just kind of put it down there. And my youths, I have three boys, and all those guys are, like, ecstatic. You know what I'm saying? And for me, it was, like, a learning because I was like, yo, they have, like, DS and Ray Tay Tay and computers. But that me passing that my own history to them, it's like when it rains, my younger son would be like, yo, daddy, let's go and race, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, like, so it's just like, these for me, these are the things that I think really makes an impact to my youth, them, you know what I'm saying? Is that those simple vibes, because I mean, Christmas comes and they open up their gifts or whatever, and then call it, you know, January 1st, it's like half of the toys are broken, you know what I'm saying? It's not really that's what's sustained. It's really the bonding, the reading and the bedtime and just sharing, you know what I'm saying? Like, I was my boy Junior, who's been on the show a couple of times. He wrote this book. I think it's Gone with the Marcus Garvey book.
Gone with the Wind, I think it is.
What is it? What's it called?
Look for Me in the Whirlwind.
Yes,
that's it. And it's like, yo, like, that was a dope bedtime reading for my youths. A, because a lot of it, the first time I read it, it was more for me because I was learning doing that. You know what I'm saying? But again, it's just like. And maybe it's a lot of it sometimes it's all my own personal headspace because it's like I didn't have that dad, you know what I'm saying? So I kind of tell myself, like, these are, you know, like, I'm making a difference, you know what I'm saying? Mm. And he's, you know, my youth is going to be like, yeah, you know, when he's giving his valedictorian speech, yeah, this is when my dad was reading this, you know what I'm saying? But, yeah, man, I think it's just fatherhood is just making it normal for my youths, you know. A couple weeks ago, we had this flag football thing, and Adrian came through and supported. He played the honorable uncle that day and brought candies for the cutes them and stuff. And I think that's what for me is what that's what the movement's about. It's just normalizing this idea of community and normalizing this idea of fatherhood. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not. Yeah, you shouldn't get a cookie for that shit. You know what I'm saying? So, anywho.
Yeah, I hear that. What I'm hearing is not so much about, like, material gain and what you can provide your children material-wise, but it's about that growth, nurturing, and development.
But, and don't get it wrong. Like, you have to, you know what I'm saying? The material vibe is, you know what I'm saying? Like, I have three boys, and it's like they go through their uniform, like, you know what I'm saying? So at the same time, though, dad has a part, but it can't be
just
when that. I was growing up, my dad's role was like school fee was paid, and then I don't see him for the next couple of months. You understand what I'm saying? That's not really, it has to be a balance, you know?
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask, because one of the things we talk about a lot on the show is, you know, things like identity in a white supremacist colonial paradigm and how, you know, how, first of all, how people navigate these systems of oppression, and also how our youth are empowered in ways that, you know, our generation wasn't necessarily. Can you talk a little bit about some of the themes around that and how it relates to some of the work that you think or that you are doing or that you see happening in the community?
Well, I mean, like, you know, and I want to make sure that I understand the question here, but like based on what I think that the question is, like we just recently did, we're wrapping up this research project, and we did it with UFT, OISE, and York, and it was looking at Black fathers, the challenges as well as the assets that we bring, right? And we did like a tour, something called the Black Family Valley Tour. It was over 10 different communities. And one of the consistent findings when we talked to some of the youths them, you know, that came out, as well as the fathers them, is that there's this lack of community, you know what I'm saying? And it's interesting because it's like, in my own head, it's like you kind of feel it, you know what I'm saying? Like in terms of you feel disconnected. Like as walking with Adrian, he said like, you know, this idea of feeling like an outsider, you know what I'm saying? And it's interesting here to hear another person say it because it's, when you're going through it in your own head, it's sort of like you're not really always in a space that you can really be vulnerable enough to really share that piece, you know what I'm saying? But I think it's important to recognize that. I think a big part of what needs to be done, I think what you guys are doing right now is creating that space for dialogue and people sharing their stories. You understand what I'm saying? So I think when we talk about a movement or what's needed, for me, Black Daddy's Club and anything that I do from this point has to be a part of documentation has to be a part of it. Like I had a conversation with an elder from the Aboriginal community, and he said something that's changed how I approach the work, and he's like, they look at it, when he's looking at his work and in his community, they look at it 7 generations ahead and 7 generations backwards. And I realized, like, for me, that was sort of like very epic, or, you know, that was like a light switch moment because of the fact that, based on the fact that I don't see myself doing Black Daddy's Club for forever. You understand what I'm saying? So it's important that documentation is a part of the work to able to leave it for the next generation. But it's also to even think about strategic-wise, like, yeah, it's important to look at where we're at now, but it's like, what is the history in terms of Black movements in Canada? You know what I'm saying? And how do you want to make a change for the future? You know, so that's sort of also the thinking as well. But I also think before we can get to, you know, these silos, I think it's super important. The one thing I took from that tour, it's like, it's super important to have like these dialogues. As simple as it is, dialogue is just key, man, because a lot of reuse them, and it goes back to the isolation piece I just mentioned. It's like we're not creating those spaces where we can be honest about the shit that we're going through. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And that is key, because regardless of if you want to call it, healing has to be a part of the work. You understand what I'm saying? And love has to be a part of the work. And it's not like this idea of this sentimental idea of love, but love has to be at the base, because it's hope. You know what I'm saying? Like, I wouldn't do this if I didn't have hope. You understand what I'm saying? It's not just to do the motions and try to balance my work life and school life and all this. Like, it's because I feel like it's bigger than me. I'm just kind of adding. This is what I feel like I can only do in terms of my own, whatever God bless me with. You understand what I'm saying? Honestly, sis, I don't want to answer your question there.
Yeah. I actually have a question for you that kind of goes back and also links to what you just said. I hear you on the idea that dialogue is so important. And I think that one of the biggest things that white supremacy has done to Black communities is severed our ability to have conversations with each other, or severely hindered it. And so I think there's a beautiful transformative moment the minute we begin talking to each other. So you had said at the beginning that when you started this whole process with the Black Daddies Club, that you shifted the way in which you did outreach and you ended up going to barbershops. Yeah. And then you did other things. I want to hear more about how you started doing outreach in the beginning, lessons you've learned since then, and then how that's affected now, how you reach out to community, and the ways in which your outreach shifting has then also shifted the ways that the dialogue is happening.
Well, I think in the beginning, because it was grassroots and there's no money in the bank, it was like, you know, partnership was key, and it still is key. You know what I'm saying? But I think the other piece, though, where I'm really fascinated about now, like, and this came out in the research piece, where when we did this research, we were trying to get Black fathers from the Caribbean diaspora, but also from the African diaspora. Mm-hmm. And it was this idea of what is Blackness kind of came up over the course of the research. And it's something that we speak about and we spoke about. And it's something that, you know, we have to look at in terms of moving forward. Because I do think this idea of just collective voice in terms of... And it's interesting, right? So it's like, I think when going to, you know, like, so for example, the example, I was in Regent Park, we had a discussion, and I went to speak to some Somali elders. And I remember approaching the elders, and it's like, they looked at me as if I was like this, I really felt like, you know, those like, those Latter-day Christians who come to your door, normally like white. And, you know, suits in the summer and shit. Like, I felt like that. I felt like there was a really disconnect, a big disconnect. Like, I didn't feel like they were looking through me like I was a brother. You understand what I'm saying? And I felt like, and then having conversations afterwards with individuals from whether the Somali community or the Eritrean community, it was like there was this conversation where they felt like in spaces, people didn't see them as Black. They saw them as, you know, these what else, you know what I'm saying? And I think that's also a piece that we have to kind of spend time on in terms of looking, it's intersections. I'm really, so to climb it up, I'm really, like, really excited by this idea of intersectionality. You understand what I'm saying? So we can, there's one way we can look at it as like, yo, I'm going to hold on to this oppression. Mm-hmm. Or we can look at it as saying, yo, where do our oppression meet? You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And for me, that's more solution-focused than holding on to the baggage, you know? So so to go back to the piece, so I think we have to kind of... Hope is lacking, so that's one piece. And it goes back to the dialogue speaking, because I can't say how we're going to create the hope. I don't think that's just my place to kind of to say. I think the community... is a part of that piece. You understand what I'm saying? And again, to throw it back to what you guys are doing here and what have been doing here, it's like creating these spaces. Because like, we can't really knock it. Like I was penetrating the other day, like how important community radio has been. Sorry, Kemba. I'm trying to get comfortable in my chair here. But.
Kemba's just, my bad for the posture. Listeners, Kemba is just pulling Brandon toward his microphone.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like I'm going all over the place here, sis. But I mean,
no, yeah. But that's the thing. The reason I was asking about dialogue and the ways that we do outreach was because my follow up question was going to be that Blackness is not a monolithic thing. Mm. That various communities have different experiences, tap into Blackness in different ways, mm-hmm. and the ways in which their Blackness is read through the world is also different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's interesting because intersectionality can also be not just a place of solidarity, but can also be a place of harm.
Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. Yeah. So June Jordan talks a lot about this in her theory geek moment. Ready? So she talks about this notion that sometimes we forget that the intersection also opens up as moving targets of harm, that there's two sides in which we're open to harm that we often don't think about. And so sometimes I think when we talk about intersectionality, we don't talk about the power dynamics that sit within those intersections. So just because you and I might say, hey, as two Black people in community, this is how we feel. But as a queer Black woman from the continent, born in Eritrea and then here, my understandings of Blackness and the ways in which I'm going to be affected will be different from you as a cis Black man from the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And so though we have intersections, there's also in those intersections different power dynamics that are going to be at play. And so I guess I'm interested really in how is it, so when you walked up to those elders, those Somali elders, and you felt a disconnect, I'm sure they also felt a disconnect. Hmm. How is it that y'all are starting to address that in Black Daddy's Club? I'm assuming that you have or have started that process. And I'm not asking to like put you on the spot in terms of give me a solution right now, but I think it's important that we talk about it. And even if you're like, yo, I'm not actually really sure how we're doing it, but these are the challenges I face, because then at least we've begun those dialogues.
Well, I mean, you know, I think for me and where we're at right now, the big piece for that was to have to start having dialogue about it. You understand what I'm saying? And really start to be strategic in terms of how. Because at the end of the day, we kind of came in with this idea that, yo, if you call it black, we're just going to have, like, you understand what I'm saying? So for us, it had that learning and that reflection had to be a part of the process. You know what I'm saying? So how we look at it is like, there's the dialogue, then there's the reflection, and then there's action. You understand what I'm saying? So it's important that we go back. And then it's also for us to kind of go back to dialogue. You know what I'm saying? And how we're going to frame that dialogue. So is it that we say, okay, we're going to start connecting and partnering with Somali groups. And then they're leading the discussions. And then we're sort of just find out how do we work together. You understand what I'm saying? Because at the end of the day, I do think when coming in as outsiders, whether it's working with LGBTQ community or working with another form of blackness, we have to recognize that piece. You understand what I'm saying? And figure out how we can connect. You understand what I'm saying? But I don't want to kind of beat it. It comes back down to the dialogue. You understand what I'm saying? Because I really feel that that's the starting point. You understand what I'm saying? Before we can unite, you understand what I'm saying? Yeah.
We need to be able to talk to each other about what that uniting means.
That's it. Because it goes back to that piece where a lot of us is in the isolation piece. Yeah. And we're dying. We're dying in our silence. You understand what I'm saying? And it's like, until we come together and start reasoning. Like, on my way down here, I dropped off my youths at basketball. And I was at a bus stop. And this dude walked past me. And he was just like, just straight grilling. You understand what I'm saying? And it wasn't like, you know, like if I know this guy or he knows. But it was like, that's his sort of... his box in terms of masculinity. Like, I have to come at you in a place of, as if it's like, you can't kill your oppressor, so you have to kill the man that looks like you. You understand what I'm saying? Because if he kills me, the police is not going to go after him as if he kills a white man or a police. You understand what I'm saying? So this is where we have to kind of stop that nonsense. We have to kind of, I'm not trying to preach, by the way, but I do think we have to have dialogues. You understand what I'm saying? So... anywho,
what's your understanding of black masculinity in terms of how you've grown through it?
And actually, I'm just going to interject because we do have to go to a very, very brief break. It's going to be really quick. And then we'll get back to Luam's question for you. You're listening to The Vibe Collective here on CIUT. And we are speaking with Brandon Hay from Black Daddy's Club. We'll be back after these messages on CIUT 89.5 FM.
Did you know you can listen to CIUT 5 different ways? Online, on satellite TV, digital cable, on FM radio, and on the go. Find CIUT online at iTunes Radio under Campus University, or go to the live stream at www.ciut.fm. You can also locate us on satellite at Star Choice Channel 826, Rogers Digital Cable Channel 946, and Bell 5 Channel 970. Listen to us on the go with TuneIn Radio's free app. And don't forget, we're on the FM dial at 89.5 FM. Spread the word. The evolution continues. CIUT 89.5 FM.
And we're back here on CIUT 89.5 FM. This is the Vibe Collective. I am Jams.
This is Kemba.
What's good? It's Luam.
Victoria Grant.
Adrian Worrell.
And Brandon Hay.
Yes, our guest from Black Daddy's Club. Shout out to Melinda, who is in transit and should be here soon. So we are speaking with Brandon Hay from Black Daddy's Club. Luam, you had a question for Brandon. Do you want to?
Yeah. So, I mean, we've been talking about dialogue and identity and fatherhood and understandings of black masculinity. And so I'm just interested to know, because identity is such an in-process thing that's always fluid and fluctuating, and in any given moment we're going to relate to our identities in different ways. I'm interested to know what your journey has been through black masculinity, from when you were young, being raised by your mother, and then growing and now being a father.
So I came across this like this line that kind of resonated this week, and it was talking in terms of like this idea of incompleteness, mm-hmm. right? So I look at myself as a black man, incomplete, mm-hmm. right? And I think that kind of, for me, that why that's important, I always ask myself, why am I always in search, Star? Like, I'm just, like, constantly in search, like, asking a lot of questions, whoever, you understand what I'm saying? And I think a part of it is just trying to figure out more about me, trying to find my voice, you understand what I'm saying? It's just this constant change. So to go back to the piece about my brought up sea, so to speak, you know, growing up, my mom was integral. My grandmother, my dad's mom, was super integral. You know what I'm saying? But then also, my uncle's them was integral. Because it's sort of like, I have all these different frameworks of masculinity to work from, you know? And with how I transferred that to with my youths is growing up being sort of slanted in the sense of, really being, you know, with my youth, I'm super nurturing, you understand what I'm saying? Which I think I got from my mom. Where with my own masculinity and then how I brought it to my youth, I was able to kind of define my own piece, you know what I'm saying? So I think when we talk about like being raised by a single mother, we sometimes talk about it from a negative piece. But I think that was, for me, that was a big, one of my benefits, you understand what I'm saying? Because I was starting from a clean slate in terms of defining my own what masculinity means, and then there's this piece where, as I get older, I'm unlearning a lot of stuff. You understand what I'm saying? And just checking like certain privileges and so forth. But also like it goes back to like having conversation with some of the men. I'm like, there's a one of my honorary advisor, Junior, is like, this is like a man who I reason with. And then some of these other cats who I just reason with on different levels. But it comes back from the space of just mutual learning. You know what I'm saying? But then also even with Black Daddy's Club and doing some of the discussions, some of the taboo discussions that we've done, I've gotten a lot of learning. Like, so a couple of years ago, we did one on monogamy, and then a few years ago, we did one on queerness in the Black community. And for me, it just, there was a lot of learning that took place in some of those spaces for me. You understand what I'm saying? So it's realizing that, A, this idea, if my youth, one of my sons came to me and said, yo, they're gay, how do I react to that? Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying? Because before, my cultural background, that's not a part of the conversation. A man looks like this and a woman looks like that, and this is how, whatever. But then over the years now, I realized that as Black men and Black people, let's talk about Black men, it's like our box is very small in terms of how we can be authentic compared to like other communities. You understand what I'm saying? And I think that's something to recognize in terms of even how I speak to my youths and how I try to, you know, I'm talking about masculinity to them, because it's like I can't have them carry on that lineage of being like, yo, I need to be this way to be a man. You understand mm-hmm. what I'm saying? Because on the realness, a lot of the ways that being told is not healthy. You understand what I'm saying? And it's just like, I wouldn't be a father to really be to really set them down that road. And it's like,
Can I ask?
Yeah.
Can I just?
Yeah.
I want to interject a question there, because what you're saying is really resonating. And
did I answer the question first of all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, yeah. What I'm hearing is just saying that Black masculinity for you has been a continual journey and something that you're still searching
Thank
and
you.
Still going through. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm just curious to know how, with your sons, how are you transmitting, you know, this particular strain of the dialogue to them, the idea of, you know, this box, and having it be so small, and how are you transmitting to them that actually this box is an illusion, and you know, there's a great vast space that you can exist in. Can you talk about how that's being taught to your youth?
I think, you know, like, a lot of it, it's sort of like it just, you know, it happens in conversation, but I think a big part of it is just being, you know what I'm saying? And not to be too vague, but what I mean by that is just like just the dynamic in the house, you know what I'm saying? Like my wife, she works shift work, so it's like, and the type of work that I do, I'm normally I'm more at home than she is. You understand what I'm saying? So whether it's like about the cook dinner, whether it's cleaning, and my wife is listening, she knows, she'd be like, yo, this guy doesn't do no dishes. You know what I'm saying? But it's just like
if you're listening, feel free to call in.
Wow.
To join the conversation.
Don't worry, I got you, man. Sorry.
I appreciate that, man. But I think, you know, like, at this age where it's like, you know, we have like these conversations where these round table conversations where it's just like reasoning, you know what I'm saying? And if situations happen where, you know, like something happens with like at school, whatever, there's just like this dialogue, you know what I'm saying? Or to answer the question, it's one piece of it is in the action, you know what I'm saying? Because it's pretty intentional for myself in terms of to be like, little things like cooking or like doing like, you know, like having them do the chores or whatever. Because again, something that's simple growing up, it's like my cousins or my female cousins or sisters, they were the ones who were taught to really do the house chores. And you know, like I didn't start doing my own laundry until I was in my second last year of high school. You understand what I'm saying? So Jameer's eyes rolls up like, oh my gosh. but that's what I'm saying. Like, I feel like a lot of the single mothers or the black women from my culture really shouldered a lot of stuff. You understand what I'm saying? And felt like they had to compensate for what the dad wasn't doing or the man wasn't doing. Where it's like, I want to change that dialogue within my youth them. Where it's like, it goes back to that piece. As simple as it's going to football or whatever, it's just to create a new narrative. You understand what I'm saying? And it's to create a new normalization. You understand what I'm saying? Because I want my youth to like, when they get of age, they move in a way that it's not foreign for them. You understand what I'm saying? So, yeah.
I've been dying to jump in for about two things, but Kemba, you want to go? Okay, so I just wanted to go back about how you mentioned kind of like having a clean slate because you were in a single soul support household and it was your mother. And I'm reading that you kind of didn't have a man there to kind of project his ideas of what masculinity is on you. And I find that when you talked about, you know, what would you do if your son, your child came to you and was like, this is what I am.
Mm-hmm.
I find that sometimes parents, whether we do it intentionally or not, we kind of have ways to like project our own things on our children. And I caught myself doing this when talking to my own young man.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say to him things like, you know, if you were to ever have a girlfriend, if you were to ever get married, and I identify a particular way, and then mm-hmm. I had to check myself and have a conversation with him, and I had to say to him, just because I love a certain way, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to love that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I say, if you were to have a girlfriend, if you were to have a wife, but I want you to know that if you were to have a boyfriend or mm-hmm. if you were to have a husband, I would want you to do the same things. I would want you to bring them over. I have to meet them. So I kind of had to like check myself to be like, okay, I identify this way, but let me not project those things onto him. Let him grow into who he is. And I just don't want to have this, you know, heteronormative dialogue and this conversation one way, and that may not be the case for him. I want him to know that it's safe and it's okay if he doesn't love in the exact same way, in the exact same manner that I love.
We'll talk.
The other thing that I wanted to talk about was, again, this whole thing with, like, black masculinity. What I really admire and appreciate with you, and this may seem so small, I don't even think you're aware of this, but you have three young men that you're raising, and I have siblings, and siblings fight. I mean, most of my siblings, we're all adults now, and we still fight, mm-hmm. like cats and dogs sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a situation where your boys were engaging in play, and they were, you know, being children, and they were fighting. And I think it was your youngest started to cry because his feelings were hurt. And what you could have done in that moment was, well, boys will be boys, and that's it. But you stopped the play, and you said, what did you do? You had a discussion, and you acknowledged, and what you did was you humanized your son for his siblings, and you said, that hurts his feelings. You need to apologize because it hurt his feelings. And when I heard that, I don't even remember how it came up. I was just like, blah, 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 because I feel like this whole thing with black masculinity is we're trying to assert like dominance and assert all these things, and we forget the aspect of humanization. And in that moment, rather than you just saying, okay, boys will be boys, let me let it go, you stopped it. You acknowledged that he's a human being with feelings, and what happened was hurtful for him. So, I mean, I just wanted to talk about that and give you props. Yeah.
So I think I've been thinking about the communities that I exist within in terms of supports, and I was hearing you talking about isolation and also listening to you talk about the 60-40 ratio, and knowing that I came to a Black Daddy's Club event where I probably saw a 70-30 ratio. And I myself experienced some frustration at the amount of space that Black women and Black mothers were taking up in that space. I don't know if you remember that particular event. I'm wondering, is that difficult for you to sit through, and what discussions have been about maybe creating spaces in which it is Black men only, however Black manhood is defined? Because I could easily see that space being Black women feeling like there's silence, right? Because I was jittery. I was like, can you stop, please? Like, there's like at least 5 young men under the age of 25 who aren't able to speak on this very important issue, and it was being recorded. It was, you know, it was an important event. So how do you experience those spaces, and what do you think can be done?
Well, I mean, I think that was the discussion up in Mornell, right? Where I feel, you know, so there's that balance, right? Because it's sort of there are events or programs that we run where it's just men-only spaces, right? And we feel like when we did Breaking Bread in Finch, we felt like we named it. Like, we had to call it men-only space. And then even with that, you get kickback as well in terms of saying, like, you know, women say, well, how come I can't come out or da-da-da? And I think...
And also the piece around how we're defining men, but like that's maybe something we can talk about later, but that's also something that I think is super important when we're talking about the notion of masculinity and how often when we're saying men, what we're not naming is what we're saying is cis men. And so whether that's something that's deliberate on your all's part, like when you guys are talking about Black Daddy's Club, but anyway, like,
so
I'll
when
let
you
say finish.
Cis man, you gotta break it down. What do you mean
by
that?
We'll talk about, like, let you finish, and then we can bring that up, because I feel like that can be a whole other story, but we'll talk.
All right. So, Kemba, the question was?
So, the question was, in spaces where you've decided to hold space for Black men, and there's an invitation, however manhood is defined, and there's spaces where Black women, Black mothers are in those spaces, how do you experience when you feel like women are, for lack of a better word, dominating those discussions where... men aren't having a chance to speak, and what do you think can be done in the future if it's not already being done? Because that event that I went to was a bit of a time ago.
Well, I think there's two pieces to that, right? So I think there's a balance of, like, okay, when we say community event, and I think Mornell was special because that was the first time we did a program in Mornell, and where we were going into like a resident, like, you know what I'm saying, and I think that the piece of it, we wanted to capture the community's voice and the first time we're going in and so forth. However, on the flip side, though, it does cause some tension. You understand what I'm saying? Because, again, it's the Black Daddy's Club. So you do want to make sure you're creating a space that Black fathers feel comfortable to share their truth, you know, and be honest. So the one thing I realized from even the barbershop sessions is that we could be having, it could be, you know, a group of men having some real dialogue, and then a woman comes in, dynamic changes on a spot. And with that being said, there's also it's also healthy to have two dialogues happening in terms of to give the opposite side, because that's where the learning takes place as well, right? Because sometimes we can kind of get carried off and kind of just go off and just kind of whatever. But I do think it's important that we have spaces where it's mixed and we can get like a shared views. But then I do think that there's times where it's absolutely imperative that it's just straight men just for us to talk and just really be honest about stuff that's going on in our lives. And that's really, for me, in those spaces where there's been like men only, that's where I find like there's the real learnings, even from for the facilitators, you know what I'm saying? Because then we're seeing in one man's story, you're seeing bits and pieces of your own. You understand what I'm saying? And again, it goes back to vulnerability and your question around masculinity. How vulnerable am I? Can I be in front of a woman? You understand what I'm saying? Or just even sometimes in front of other men? You know what I'm saying? So it's like, and these are things that we have to kind of, and again, some of these men's spaces, it's not just one-off. We normally, these, when we do like a man-only space, it's normally like a four workshop, or like, you know what I'm saying? Because we know that trust, it's important that the men trust the process. And it's important that these men can build a space where they can, okay, I'm going to go and go off on a limb and share. And when that happens, then you find there is, it becomes a thing where it's not facilitated by whether it's Junior and Chevy or myself. It becomes the men are facilitating the conversation on their own, because they're like, yo, I'm having this issue where, you know what I'm saying, like my baby mom's is taking me to courts and I'm not finding no justice in the court system. You understand what I'm saying? Where if we come in from the first, we're not going to get that conversation on the first night, because they're kind of sussing out the vibe. They're trying to see, you understand what I'm saying? So again, it's important that we raise that space.
And so, yeah, so I think going back to this understanding of like,
are you going to explain what cis
men? I'm about to break it down just now. Ready? Okay. So when I say cis men, what I mean is that your gender and sex in the normative sense match up.
Right.
So you identify as, in terms of gender, the way you present, move through the world, what is understood normatively as masculine, and that you're also born with a flesh penis. So mm-hmm. that's what I say when I say cis men.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important that we pay attention to language, because so much of language is so political, and it's the ways in which we interact with each other and understand our identities. And so I hear the tension in terms of making sure that when we're talking about black fatherhood, that people who identify as black fathers are given the space to be able to communicate with each other, to share struggles and to share resources and just source of kind of ways of moving in the world. But I wonder how we're creating those spaces. And I know we only have 10 minutes left, so it's not definitely something we can address, but I at least wanted to at least bring it up, is how the inclusion of black trans fathers is being addressed in Black Daddies Club, and making sure that we're not excluding because we're only understanding black fatherhood in this extremely heteronormative way, populations that also need support, that also will challenge the ways in which we're understanding black masculinities, which is part of the reason I was asking you how you understand your own black masculinity, because then that's going to affect the ways in which we have conversation. And I've heard you throughout the last hour talk about queerness and talk about the ways in which Black Daddy's Club is bringing that up. And so that makes me really happy as a queer black woman to hear that. But I think I'm challenging you a little bit here to push your understandings around what fatherhood really means, to be able to distill that. Because I think inadvertently we could potentially be alienating and potentially isolating people who are on the trans spectrum who identify as fathers and who also need spaces and who are also black to be able to talk about their struggles and to find root and courage and vision with each other.
So I think that's an excellent question, and I think from back to back it up, when we did the discussion leading up to the Queer as Black Folk event a few years back, we had these small fire events. So going into barbershops to have conversation on the topic, but also going to queer spaces. Mm-hmm. And one of the learnings that I took from when we went to BQI over at Soy, and big up to Lorelei King, and it's just like a dope space. However, the realization that we had to come as outsiders, it was myself, Junior, and Kim Crosby, and if Kim wasn't there, like, you know what I'm saying, and Lorelei was like, it's like, hey, as straight men, we realize that there's a power shift. You understand what I'm saying? And the relationship that these guys have had with black men has not always been positive.
With black cis men.
With black cis men. Thank you very much. You know what I'm saying? But one, a man has said something that was important, and he's like, every time we're going to have these dialogues, it's always of us being queer LGBTQ individuals going to straight spaces to having these dialogues. Mm-hmm. Where what you guys are doing in terms of coming into our spaces and having these dialogues is something different. And I think it goes back to the piece of partnering. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying? Because it's something different to say, yeah, I'm going to come and have a conversation with queer dads, mm-hmm. and just come in as us, you know what I'm saying, by ourselves, and then boom, like, because the realities of it is different. Even though there's intersections, there's a lot of pieces that's not, you know what I'm saying. So this is where it comes to, like, you know, partnership with, like, you know, I don't know, like Black Cap or so, you know, and this has been the model that we've been doing, you know what I'm saying. So it's, again, there's more work to be done. You know what I'm saying? I'm not, you know, so again.
And I bring that question knowing that, right? And I think it was also in part wanting to have the listeners know that Black Daddy's Club is working on that. And through the partnership model is trying to not replicate the colonial ways of interacting, where it's like a bunch of black cis men going into queer and trans spectrum spaces and saying, this is what masculinity is. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested, and I will continue to follow in terms of the partnership model and how that can expand these conversations. So I think that's beautiful. So big up.
I'm loving this conversation. If I may, I just...
Yo, hold on. I was hoping, like, I'd hear Adrian talk a little bit.
Well, I'm
guys, just like, I'm like, yo.
I'm gonna ask Adrian a question. And
I'm trying to just hide out.
Yeah. No, I'm gonna ask Adrian a question. I'd like his input on this, and I'd like Brandon, of course, your input on this. For any young men who may be listening, growing up in single soul support households, and it's maybe just them and their mother, or maybe for whatever reasons they don't have their father present, or they perhaps maybe even would like a better relationship with their father. Mm-hmm. For those young individuals who are listening, what are the ways in which, I guess, mentorship can happen, and kind of filling, I don't know if void is the correct word, but it's like, if my, for example, if my son's father, for whatever reason, isn't there in his life, but he may feel as if he would like some sort of, there's just certain questions mm-hmm. that he's just not going to be comfortable mm-hmm. asking me, you know, and I can be loving and supportive, but we don't share the same anatomy. And, my experience and his experiences, they're going to be different. What are the ways in which single soul support mothers can include, I guess, other men? Does it have to necessarily look like a father or a stepfather? I guess, how would you respond? I'm going to ask the two gentlemen here for young men who are listening.
Well, I mean, I think back to growing up, like some of the points you raised earlier about, like, the first, like, that idea of the box of masculinity, I didn't exactly grow up with that. I encountered that later as, like, as a teen. My dad always used to cook for us, and he was just a very eccentric person, shall we say. You know? But so, like, that whole idea, and then I had uncles that used to braid their daughter's hair, and, like, so it was my image of, you know, the Caribbean masculinity didn't quite fit the box that I hear people talking about. I recognize certain things in it. My actual personal experience of that, it's kind of like, I didn't even know it, like, that the idea of the box or the stereotype had that much currency, based on what I had experienced. And I grew up around a lot of black men. Like, you know, a wave of us came, well, them, I was born here, but a wave of them came. I always think that I'm not from here.
that's deep what you just said.
But so they kind of stuck together, I guess, when they first came as a kind of immigrant community, whatever. And so there were a wide range of like men who I could look to, you know, in my community, or not even, they didn't even live necessarily in my community per se, but I knew that every Friday I was going to see Uncle So-and-so and Auntie So-and-so and then cricket on Saturday. So I grew up around this, a lot of examples of community, in a sense, in the news, and, you know, back in the day, right? So it was like, you know, some of the ideas around, single parents. I mean, we did have people in that who they weren't necessarily married to the partner, or they had been separated, or whatever the case was. And not to make it seem like it was perfect, because it certainly wasn't. But there was this idea of, well, you know, help somebody out, you know, like, or you. There was this kind of, there were a whole lot of other men to look up to, in a sense, and it wasn't necessarily anything that had to be formalized. I don't, you know, that's not my recollection. But it was just something that just you kind of did as a sense in a community. You know, my father, he grew up without his dad. His dad was, had went away for work, like, forever. And so he had that similar thing growing up in the Caribbean as well. So, again, I guess I presume a lot, but I always presumed that these were some of the things that we would have retained going forward. But then I noticed, like, around in, like, again, the 90s or so, that stuff started trying to dissolve. I think what was also important in some sense was also, like, the idea of clubs and stuff like that was useful as well. Like, being, I guess now what the equivalent would be like being in a league or something like that, and meeting, you know, mentors and through that, but also just in the general community, like just a social network, and look for people who are reliable, responsible, who are going to take on some type of role in that regard.
Okay, thank you very much, Adrian. Brandon, how would you respond?
I think, you know, like, so Carl James, professor at York, he said, he talks about this idea of mentorship versus sponsorship, right? And before, I didn't really quite understand. I thought it was interesting. And he doesn't really believe in mentorship. He believes more in sponsorship, right? And I thought that was dope because of the fact that I never really grew up with mentors. You know what I'm saying? I think I had sponsors, like, as Adrian talked about, like, uncles and stuff. Like, growing up with my mom, it's like we had uncles. I had uncles here and then uncles back in Jamaica or some in England and so forth. And I didn't really put them on a pedestal to say, yo, you can't do no wrong. Sorry, you can't do no wrong. And I'm going to take everything. I want to be exactly like you. But it was more like I'm going to take bits and pieces. You understand what I'm saying? So, you know, like my uncle, one of my uncle in Brampton, you know, he coaches his all of his youth soccer. You know what I'm saying? Like, he was engaged. He was, you know, making porridge in the morning. Like, and that's the little things I took. I'm like, yo, that's what I want. When I become a father, that's the piece that I want to take, dear. You understand what I'm saying? Then another uncle who got dipped to Jamaica, and it's like when I went back, it was just like he cooked. He was like, he had to, again, when you get deported, you have to figure out, like, you know, fall back on whatever skills you could. And for him, he cooking was one of them. So you would cook for the garage and people on the street. You know what I'm saying? But again, it's to watch how these men, like, in terms of cooking, like, you know, cooking was a big piece, you know, like watching these men do certain things. But for me, it really comes down to having these dialogues with these men, you know what I'm saying, and taking bits and pieces. And I can't even front, like, to say, like, it was all from men, you know what I'm saying? My aunts had a big role in that, too, you know? So my aunt, also from England, like, I remember, like, when I was, you know, like, I don't know, 18, like, she gave me my first Act of Faith book, you know, the even Jana Van Zandt book, you know what I'm saying? And that was dope for me, you know what I'm saying, where I walked around and, you know, she was burning a spliff and she said, she passed me a spliff and I was like, yo, this is my, you know, this is my art. You know what I'm saying? I'm sorry. I shouldn't be talking about this on your show.
No,
I apologize.
It's fine.
You're talking about medicine.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. So, but again, it's that piece around just having authentic conversation with these individuals, these elders, you understand what I'm saying? Where I think that's important because, again, they share certain pieces with me, and I think it was that piece of, for me to go back to that searching, to dig deeper, you know what I'm saying? But yeah,
I'd also say, like, I noticed, like, things seem to go in the opposite direction, whereas, like, I know there's one thing that made situations worse was, like, a kind of, like, classism that kind of sprung up, whereas if you didn't come from this particular home, then all these things were necessarily attributed to your behavior. And, you know, that doesn't – narrative doesn't hold up statistically across the board. There are very specific things that lead to, you know, those correlations that whichever studies like to draw into focus. But it would seem that, you know, in place of community, we had people in the quote-unquote community reenacting and holding on to those values and treating people differently based on, you know, based on those factors. And that would end up, you know, a lot of times, oftentimes exacerbating things or making, you know, become self-fulfilling prophecies in a sense, you know. So there was a certain kind of stigma that people embraced and put on certain people, which didn't make sense for me because, you know, like seeing a lot of the people who I'd known, who I actually looked up to, they'd come from single parents' homes in a sense, and they had gone on and done all these wonderful things. It was, you know, the Caribbean, it's pretty, you know, I won't say it's normal, but it's like it's not that uncommon. So it was, it seemed like there was a time where people just did the opposite of what seemed to make sense collectively in terms of nurturing people in these situations and kind of dismantling and picking apart the good that we had and replacing it with I don't exactly know what. And now it seems like we're kind of snapping out of it with things like this and, you know, restarting them, you know. And so I find that's really positive and, you know, reason for optimism.
Well, on that note, we've come to the end of the hour. It goes by really quickly. So we've got to go to some ads. But before we do, I want to thank Brandon Hay for joining us today.
Thank all of you guys. And Mally just came in. I did my first time meeting Mally, actually. I see her on Facebook all the time. But it's you know, the dopeness about this whole thing here, it's like there's like a slew of people here that is sort of like I kind of watch and creep on Facebook sometimes. You know what I'm saying? So I was joking with Victoria where I was just like, yo, because like in your own rights, each of you guys are like marvelous people. You know what I'm saying? And it's sort of like, so I came in, I was like super intimidated. I'm just like, yo, are you sure? Like can I call Chevy or Junior to, like, you know what I'm saying, to kind of be here? I think that's more. Because I'm here talking about spliffs, and I don't know the vibe of your show. Like, you know, but thank you very much for having me, man. That was dope. Appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, it was good having you. It was good hearing really from you. Good. And, yeah. And you know, I think it's really important for our listeners to hear about the work that you're doing and about the dialogues that are being held in these spaces. And, you know, and the kinds of challenges that are happening within these spaces, because, you know, a lot of these conversations, they're normal for certain communities to have, but it does seem taboo, especially when you're talking about masculinity and cisgender and intersectionality. Those types of things tend to scare people away. So we're really happy that you were here and able to share in that space with us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Yeah. So we are the Vibe Collective, and we consist of myself, Jams.
Mally, a.k.a. Docu Vixen. Kemba.
A.K.A. Meme.
I'm saying, though, like, what happened to the...
It's because, yo, she's trying to solidarity with me and just the Luam piece. That's why. Thank you, Kemba.
I'm Victoria Grant.
I'm Adrian.
And shout out to Adnan, Budnan.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, mad love to him. So we're the Vibe Collective Heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. From 3 to 4, we have these roundtable reasoning sessions. And then from 4 to 5, we bring you music to move you, which we are about to do after the break. And if you want to follow along, you can follow us on Twitter. We are at Vibe Collective. Like us on Facebook. We would like you back. And so get ready, because DJ Griffin is about to drop some music on your ears here on the Vibe Collective CIUT 89.5 FM.
Ani Bojo, Tanse, Sego, Wache, and Hello. Indigenous Waves is a celebration of Indigenous cultures locally, nationally, and globally. Through music, storytelling, interviews, panel discussions, art, and humor, we explore the diversity of Indigenous peoples. Indigenous Waves can be heard here on CIUT every Monday from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you can always catch our podcasts at indigenouswaves.com. Follow us on Twitter at Indigenous Waves to stay up to date with Indigenous Waves here on CIUT 89.5 FM.
Your donations keep CIUT 89.5 FM on the air. We would not be able to do what we do without you. The CIUT 89.5 FM Fall Membership Drive is happening October 21st to the 27th. Donate before October 20th and you will be entered into a special early bird draw for a Samsung Galaxy Note. Full details are available at www.ciut.fm.
CIUT 89.5, the sound of your city.